This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, July 5th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, violence erupts in Egypt after the military responds to pro-Morsi supporters rallying in Cairo. Privacy advocates build on 4th of July rallies to push for changes to the U.S. government spying programs. And we'll go to India, where thousands protest 5 major dams along the Narmada River, saying their livelihoods are at stake. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. As supporters of deposed President Mohamed Morsi protest today in Cairo, governments around the world are beginning to take sides. Reaction in the Middle East has been mixed, with leaders calling the overthrow either a triumph of people power against overreaching Islamists or a flagrant military coup that's deposed a democratically elected leader. FSRN's Jacob Resnick explains.
Syria's leadership says the military intervention, backed by public protest, to topple Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi represents the overthrow of political Islam. Meanwhile, Syria's only regional ally, Iran, expressed guarded disappointment. Under Morsi, Egypt had made moves to reestablish ties with Iran, which were severed following the 1979 revolution. The Arab League Secretary General sent a message of congratulations to the, quote, Egyptian people for what it called an historic achievement. Egypt's interim leader has also been welcomed by Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and even Qatar, whose emir had extended Morsi's government $7.5 billion in loans and grants since 2011. Meanwhile, the African Union has suspended Egypt from all activities, while Tunisia has called the military action a flagrant coup. But perhaps the deposed Egyptian president's most stalwart friend is Turkey. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, whose own Islamist-rooted AK Party has been the target of recent protests, has called for Morsi's immediate release from house arrest and reinstatement as leader. Pro-government NGOs have organized pro-Morsi rallies in cities across Turkey, including Istanbul. Hundreds rallied in the Old Quarter following Friday prayers while holding pictures of President Morsi and waving Egyptian and Turkish flags. Ahmed Laysi of Cairo is visiting Turkey with his family and joined today's protest. Laysi says polarization in Egypt is at dangerous levels, but that Morsi supporters are prepared for the worst.
I'm afraid for more violence, but freedom deserves some blood, you know?
The UN is voicing concerns about the military takeover, but other countries like the US and Canada have been publicly neutral, calling for a democratic process and finding a solution to Egypt's unfolding crisis. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
FSRN will have more about the situation on the ground in Egypt later in the program. The French government intercepts and collects phone and online communications data of its citizens. The French paper Le Monde reports the country's version of the NSA has been collecting individual data through a program similar to PRISM, the U.S. spy program recently brought to light by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. The French spying program appears to have been active since 2008, not collecting the content of the messages, but who was communicating with whom, when, and how often. Le Monde says the program is not legally authorized in France. Yesterday, France officially rejected an asylum request from Edward Snowden, but also extended an apology to Bolivian President Evo Morales. Earlier this week, the country denied Morales' plane permission to enter its airspace on suspicion that the plane was carrying the NSA leaker. Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court has struck down an appeal to delay national elections. The court previously set election day for July 31st, but both the president and prime minister, who are often at odds, argued that the country needs more time to prepare for fair elections. FSRN's Girikai Chanza reports from Harare.
Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai and MDC party leader Washman Ncube appealed to delay the general election to allow more time to reform the security forces and state media. President Robert Mugabe initially followed the court order and set elections for the end of the month, but then came out in support of the delay. On Thursday, the High Court unanimously rejected the request. Tsvangirai's attorney Louis Uriri told reporters after the ruling that his client is going to abide by the court's decision.
It is the obligation of every Zimbabwean to uphold this constitution, to uphold the very fabric of the republic, and it is a judgment that has been made by the court. It is accepted.
Tsvangirai has indicated he plans to launch his party's election platform on Sunday. The 61-year-old prime minister who challenged 89-year-old incumbent Robert Mugabe for the presidency. After violently contested elections in 2008, the two agreed to a power-sharing deal. Garika Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
The mother and brother of slain Florida teen Trayvon Martin took the stand today in the trial of accused shooter George Zimmerman. Both said the voice crying for help in the background of a 911 call from a neighbor belonged to the 17-year-old shooting victim. That point is highly contested by Zimmerman's lawyers. After questioning their final witnesses, Florida state prosecutors rested their case. And finally, commuter train service in the San Francisco Bay Area resumed this afternoon after a temporary deal was reached between BART officials and striking workers. Representatives from two employee unions and BART agreed to a 30-day contract extension while wider negotiations continue. Workers had been on strike since Monday. State mediators have been leading the negotiations. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Egypt, at least three protesters were shot dead and dozens more injured outside the Republican Guard headquarters after security forces fired on crowds rallying in support of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. An AP video shows crowds tending to injured and bloody protesters as others hold posters of Morsi and chant. The army has denied firing live rounds at the crowd, but the BBC had a reporter at the scene who was himself injured by shotgun pellets and reports that soldiers did fire on protesters. Massive pro-Morsi crowds also gathered outside Rabah Adawiyah Mosque, where Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohamed Badi told supporters that their revolt is peaceful and will stay peaceful, and their demonstrations are stronger than bullets and tanks. Many thought Badi had been arrested Thursday. This evening, crowds continued to fill the streets with tensions rising between those for and against the deposed president. Egypt's new leader, Adli Mansour, Chief Justice of the Supreme Constitutional Court, was sworn in as the interim president Thursday. While he called for an inclusive process, many have raised concerns about the military's actions over the last few days, including the arrests of Muslim Brotherhood members, the raiding of several news stations and detention of journalists, and the attacks that took place earlier today. For more, we spoke with Sarah Salem. She's a staff writer with Mufta, a site that provides news and analysis on the Middle East and North Africa. She joined us from Cairo. Sarah Salem, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
So there was the Muslim Brotherhood rally today in support of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. They were met by security forces outside the Republican Guard headquarters. As we noted earlier in the program, there were several deaths, more injuries. What's been the response to this latest confrontation?
I think until now people are still a bit confused about what happened and what started it, whether the protesters were armed or whether the military or the police fired first. But I think there has been condemnation from Tomorrow and many protesters. And the Supreme Guide of the Muslim Brotherhood just gave a speech saying that they will continue fighting, basically, until Morsi is president again.
So some of the details still coming out, still to be confirmed. There are also reports that Morsi is still under house arrest. Is there any word on his status, if he's been taken into detention or what kinds of conditions he's being held under?
It's still unsure where he is. I don't think he's under house arrest. I think he's being kept either in the Ministry of Defense or another government building. But I don't think he's at home. It's still also very unclear where he is and how many Muslim Brotherhood members have actually been arrested, because everyone thought the Supreme Guide that just gave a speech had been arrested, and apparently he hasn't been. So still a lot of details haven't come out yet.
Is it Mohamed Badi who gave the speech today?
Yes.
And previously it was reported that he was taken under arrest along with his deputy, so that appears to not be accurate at this point, I guess.
Right.
Also, Adli Mansour, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Constitutional Court, was sworn in as the interim president. Is it clear what exactly his powers are at the moment as head of state?
They aren't as widespread as everyone thinks because the constitution has been suspended. I think he's basically here for the next 3 to 6 months until presidential elections happen to oversee the roadmap. I think a lot of people suspect that it is the military in charge. And a lot of actions were taken today, I think, were not decisions necessarily made by him. However, he is officially the person running the country.
Sarah Salam, in your recent article in Mufta, you make the point that saying that this marks the return of military rule is not accurate because, in a sense, in Egypt, military rule has never left. Can you explain?
Right. So basically, since 1952, the military regime has been very strong in Egypt. And while for most of the time it hasn't officially governed the country, it does have very large economic and political assets, and so has been a major factor in most decision-making processes. One of the few times where it was actually governing the country openly was after the 2011 revolution, where it managed the transition. But I don't think we should discount it even after Morsi became president. I think that it's important to note that, as in most countries in the world, the military is an important institution.
So after these deadly clashes today, what will you be looking at in terms of how the military handles this interim period? What kind of decisions that they make?
Right. So I think the key thing to look out for is how they deal with the threat coming from the Muslim Brotherhood now, who have openly said that they will be challenging the decision made to remove Morsi from power. So I think for the next few weeks, that's what's going to be the key thing to look out for. After that, I think that they would prefer to leave what happens in the hands of the new interim president.
The military has suspended the constitution. General Abdel Sisi said this week that part of the so-called roadmap would be to draft a new constitutional charter. The last version had received criticism from civil society groups, religious minorities, women's groups. What are the important issues in this process ahead?
So I think the key problem last time was the lack of inclusivity. I think most of the opposition, whether liberal or secular, walked out of the process because they felt they weren't actually being able to voice their opinion. So I think this time the most important move that needs to be made is that there is a representative coalition of people writing this constitution, which has to also include the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis. I mean, I think excluding political Islamists at this point is also a mistake that shouldn't be made. So I think before we even talk about the actual, what is actually in constitution, I think the body writing it and making the amendments needs to be representative of the Egyptian political scene.
That's Sarah Salem. She's a staff writer with Mufta, a site that provides news and analysis on the Middle East and North Africa. She joined us from Cairo, Egypt. Women are also increasingly reporting harassment and sexual assault in the thick crowds of Tahrir Square, the symbolic center of the protests that came ahead of Morsi's removal earlier this week. At least one woman has reported rape by a sharp object, according to rights groups and monitors in Cairo, who have also documented nearly 170 sexual assaults by mobs in Tahrir Square since Sunday, 80 on Wednesday night alone. The group Operation Anti-Sexual Harassment and Assault also confirmed 46 attacks on June 30th. One woman from the violence prevention group Tahrir Bodyguard told The Guardian that she narrowly escaped an attempt at assault this week as her group tried to prevent attacks on other women. Two women, Hania Mohib and Yasmin El Baramawi, described to Human Rights Watch how they were attacked when they attended protests last year and early 2013.
They made a very tight circle around me. They started moving their hands all over my body. They touched every inch of my body. They violated every inch of my body. I was so much traumatized, I was only screaming at the time. I couldn't even speak. I couldn't cry help. I was just screaming.
A car backed up and stopped on my hair. So they took advantage of the fact that I was trapped on the ground. They held my legs and turned me around. They raised my legs up and raped me as they wish. This was my weakest point.
Mohib and El Baramawi, along with five other women, filed a joint complaint with authorities and gave testimony in March, but 3 months later, no attackers have been identified or indicted. Sexual assault and harassment of women in Egypt is a long-running issue. Heba Morayef is the Egypt director for Human Rights Watch. She said such mob assaults happen in the absence of police presence or serious accountability from the government.
Impunity in these mobs and the violence against women has led to a situation where the perpetrator feels that he won't be held accountable. It has also led to a rise in these types of attacks. At the same time, several initiatives to protect women have been launched by activists and civil society as a result of the state's failure to protect women and the lack of accountability in crimes of violence against women.
Rights groups such as Operation Anti-Sexual Harassment and Assault send out volunteers to intervene in attacks and prevent assaults from happening. The group also runs a hotline for survivors of attacks, but advocates say government action is needed to address the broad problem. Gada Talhami, emeritus professor in the Department of Politics at Lake Forest College, has tracked the development of women and politics in Egypt through the decades. She told FSRN that the latest attacks on women could be partly a reaction to their growing political visibility.
I think there will always be male attempts to prevent women from being in the public space. And seeing women in the public space, particularly by conservative reactionary elements, is usually very upsetting. And the only attack they have against it is to attack women physically.
The problem also extends beyond the protest zone. According to a UN survey in April, 99% of Egyptian women report being sexually harassed during the course of their daily lives. You're listening to FSRN. Each weekday, Free Speech Radio News brings you critical and undercovered stories from around the globe through our network of 200 grassroots reporters on six continents.
It's bringing to the public the things that they ought to know, that they ought to understand about the world, about their own circumstances, things that are not being brought to them in at least in honest and a way without distortion by the news sources that are regularly available to them. It's a huge gap to be filled, and Free Speech Radio is doing a very important job in filling it.
Join Noam Chomsky in supporting global grassroots radio journalism. For more information and to find out about our DVD interview with Professor Chomsky, go to fsrn.org. Organizers with the newly formed coalition Restore the Fourth say they plan to continue advocating for privacy protections after holding nearly 100 rallies in cities across the U.S., including San Francisco, New York City, Tampa, and Washington, on the 4th of July. The rallies came together following the revelations in June about the U.S. government's widespread surveillance of personal phone and online data. FSRN's Alice Olstein attended the Restore the Fourth rally in Washington, D.C., and brings us this report.
Why are we here?
Restore the Fourth!
Why are we here?
Restore the Fourth!
NSA still can't hear you. Why are we here?
Restore the Fourth!
Why are we really here?
Just blocks from the White House, a few hundred people rallied on Independence Day to protest the mass domestic and international surveillance carried out by the U.S. government. Many held signs praising and thanking intelligence analyst Edward Snowden, whose leaks to The Guardian exposed a number of these secret spying programs. The crowd cheered at the chance to hear from another whistleblower in person, former National Security Agency executive Thomas Drake. Like Snowden, Drake was charged by the Obama administration under the Espionage Act for exposing dragnet spying and wasteful spending at the NSA. Most charges against him were dropped in 2011, after the government raided his home, revoked his security clearance, and threatened him with decades in prison. On Thursday, he urged the demonstrators to declare their independence from the surveillance state.
The government has given up on the Constitution. Have you?
No!
They've revoked the Fourth Amendment. Have you?
No!
They're granting themselves unfettered access to know everything there is about us. Do you want them to do that?
No!
The Restore the Fourth protest took place in McPherson Square, a downtown park that last year held one of the nation's longest-running Occupy encampments. Many of the same people who slept in tents for months and repeatedly marched on K Street lobbyist offices joined the Independence Day demonstration against government spying. One of them was local activist Carl McClinton, who says he came because he's seen firsthand the chilling effect surveillance has had on activism in D.C., as fewer people have been showing up to meetings and protests.
It puts fear in a lot of people's heart that they're being watched for no reason, and you know, that they can say something that it could be taken the wrong way or could be interpreted the wrong way, and they're just decent American citizens.
McClinton and several other activists said they came to the rally to find out what concrete steps they can take to oppose the government's actions. Some speakers urged them in the next election to vote out of office all members of Congress who voted for the bills that enabled the surveillance, including the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Others urged them to pressure those on Capitol Hill to fully investigate the NSA and other agencies who have been conducting the surveillance, and to pass bills to roll back their power to do so. Others asked for support in waging legal battles. Amy Stepanovich with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, described her organization's latest plan to take on the surveillance state.
There's this really great little law called the Administrative Procedure Act, and it says that an agency like the NSA cannot do anything that has a substantive impact on anybody's rights without getting input from people. Now, I wasn't asked by the NSA if I could have my information collected and put in a database. Were any of you asked? I don't think so. So we wrote to the NSA. We got public sign-ons. We're submitting to the NSA a petition every single week until they respond and ask why they did not come to the public, as required by the law, to get input on this program.
EPIC is also preparing a petition to the U.S. Supreme Court, asking them to overturn the order by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, authorizing the mass collection of domestic phone records. Stepanovich and her colleagues plan to submit this petition on Monday. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In India's state of Madhya Pradesh, thousands of people are protesting the building of five major dams on the Narmada River. The dams will displace local residents and farmers who say the government's offers to help relocate them are falling short. FSRN's Shurya Niazi reports.
Braving the rain and singing songs in local dialect, thousands of protesters staged a sit-in in the capital city of Bhopal as part of a five-day-long protest. They have covered more than 100 miles to reach the city. It has been a long battle for more than 400,000 people who are affected by five dams: Indira Sagar, Omkarishwar, Maheshwar, Man and Upper Beda. The dams, which are in various stages of construction, are part of a hydroelectricity project that officials say will light 500,000 homes and provide irrigation facilities to 20,000 hectares of land. But the protesters allege that the government has failed to provide area residents and landowners with proper funds for rehabilitation and resettlement. Alok Agrawal is the leader of Narmada Bachao Andolan, an organization fighting for the rights of dam-affected people. He points to a Supreme Court decision in 2011 that said the state government had a constitutional obligation to fully compensate people displaced from their homes.
We are ready to fight until the very end. The government should accept the demand or be ready to face electoral loss. Thousands of evictees will vote against the government in the elections.
At the tent encampment in Bhopal, the protesters sing a traditional tribal song about winning the battle. Many say they will keep up this fight until their demands are met.
Sakubai is a protester from Omkarishwar.
Our demand is very clear. We should be given land for land, and everyone should be given a minimum of 5 acres of land. Otherwise, we are not ready to move from our place and will not demolish our houses. If the government decided to go ahead with their work, then we will submerge ourselves. We want the government to give us at least $10,500 per acre as compensation. How can we survive without this?
Under the state government package, landless families would be given $4,500 and must demolish their own homes by July 15th. Farmers would be given $3,600 per acre. Protesters include Savitri Bai say they are not ready to accept inadequate compensation from the government.
The government has made empty promises with us. The amount offered by the government is far below the market rate. Now the government wants us to accept $3,600 per acre, which is far below the existing market rate. If the government is not ready to accept our demands, then they should empty the dams and hand over the land back to us.
The protesters allege that thousands of families have been excluded from the lists of those displaced and many were not given compensation, even though large areas of land are already flooded. Those who have received compensation were asked to sign an agreement preventing them from seeking further compensation. For those who have resettled miles away from their original homes, many complain that they lack basic infrastructure for healthcare and education. Local leader Subhash Patel is concerned about the young people in this newly established community.
I don't know how our children will get an education. They have constructed buildings, but classes aren't being organized. Education is available to children, but at faraway places. To send our children to cities for education is not at all an easy task. It is difficult to send them to other cities, as we are left with no money.
The affected people are pressing the administration and the state government to accept their demands just before the assembly elections scheduled for November. Alok Agrawal warns that the evictees are ready to teach a lesson to the state government.
The government has violated the Supreme Court orders. Evictees should be given land for land, and they should also be given other facilities to be rehabilitated. More than 90% of the people have been denied proper compensation and rehabilitation by the state government.
Last year, 51 people stayed immersed in Omkarishwar Dam water for 17 days to fight the state government's decision to raise the water level in the dam from 189 to 193 meters. The protest ended after the chief minister assured them that the height of the dam will not be increased and they would also consider their demands for rehabilitation and adequate compensation. Many say that they have been deceived by the state government and will keep fighting for their rights. Shuranyazi, FSRN, Bhopal, India.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Shauna Ray and Carla West. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Special thanks to Teddy Wilson. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.